A matter of Philip Pantano and Phyllis Pantano versus New York Shipping Association. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Chief Justice. Patrick Minter with Donald and Minter Kelly. Also, who's here today is my partner, Jerry.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Associate Justice Matthew Stafford from the Bureau of Law on behalf of the respondents, Philip and Phyllis Pantano. My associate, Andrew Bloom.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Minter.
Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, may it please the court. Mr. Chief Justice, may I just reserve a minute or two for a rebuttal?
Yes.
Thank you. On behalf of my client, I come before the court today requesting reversal of the appellate division's order and reinstatement of the order of dismissal that was entered by the trial court in May of 2020. I recognize that the court has before it substantial briefing. So in addition to answering any questions that the court may have, I'd like during my presentation just to highlight three points, if I could. The first point that I'd like to highlight is the manner in which the borrowed servant doctrine issue here was addressed at the trial level was the product of an explicit agreement amongst all parties, the plaintiffs, my clients, and ultimately the court. This is a fact that's simply undeniable, and it was not until the case reached this court that the plaintiffs, for the first time, argued that the borrowed servant analysis should be one that's reserved for the jury. And quite frankly, that position taken here brings about and implicates the invited error doctrine. That's our first point. And our second point really goes to the main point that we were granted cert on, which is how should this court deal with the borrowed servant doctrine? Should it be determined as a matter of law, or should it be determined as a question of fact? And just as a precursor to my comments, all the law that we had when we tried this case suggested that it should be determined as a matter of law. And we would ask that that hold true going forward. However, if this court determines to announce a new rule on the issue, we would ask, and I'll get into a little bit more of the detail, that the new rule be applied prospectively here rather than retroactively. And finally, as a point of emphasis at the end of my presentation, I'd also like to emphasize the points that go to the fact that the trial judge here got it right when he examined the factors that the Galveo court set forth when you do a borrowed servant analysis. He analyzed control over both on spot and broad. And he analyzed, although he didn't have to get to the issue, he analyzed business furtherance and got that right as well. So let me first talk about briefly the issue of the fact that the way we handled this at trial in 2019 was the product was definitively the product of an agreement amongst all of us. Now, we quoted in our brief at footnote 2, it is rather lengthy, but we wanted the court to have a real context for the agreement. And this was an agreement that all of us believed was the way to handle this the borrowed servant issue. And it's important to add the context. The defense, my clients, we moved for summary judgment prior to trial on the borrowed servant doctrine issue, and the motion was denied based on the presence of disputed issues of fact. So when we were called in for trial, all parties, the defense, the plaintiffs, agreed or urged the court, I should say, to consider the borrowed servant doctrine as a question of law that should be reserved for the court. And we quoted in our brief, and I just want to quote it here because I think it's important to the invited error doctrine issue, that the plaintiff's counsel stated, and I'll give you two quotes, "I do believe it's a legal question that at the end of the evidence, Your Honor should make, the court should make," end quote. Second quote, "I think whether or not Mr. Giamello is a borrowed employee at the time that this accident occurs, I really think that, under the case law, is for Your Honor to decide," end quote. Now, the defense completely agreed with that proposition. It was essentially a joint application, to be fair, but those were the words of plaintiff's counsel. So we were surprised when we submitted simultaneous briefs here that the only point in the plaintiff's brief urged the court to consider the borrowed servant issue as a question of law, as a question of fact to be reserved for a jury. That's the polar opposite position of that which was taken at the trial court level. And quite frankly, in this court's pronouncements under the invited error doctrine, they should be barred from taking a position that's contrary to the polar opposite of the position that they urged the court to take at the trial.
Well, Mr. Minter, of course, a right to a jury can always, in civil matters, be waived through pleadings or otherwise. So is it necessarily inconsistent for the plaintiff to say to us, and consistent with some older cases that said it, that generally this is a jury question, but you have the prerogative, if you want to waive the jury, to do so?
I think, Justice, I think in the context of this case, this explicit, because this is an unusual circumstance, there was an explicit agreement about how to handle this. And we explicitly, all of us agreed that this was going to be carved out and essentially be a bench trial on the issue of the borrowed servant doctrine.
Which meant you wanted the judge to make the call.
All of us did.
Okay.
Yes.
Help us understand why that needs our focus now, because what we have is a straightforward legal question that was presented in your cert petition that the court granted. And looking at the questions presented, it is vicarious liability under the borrowed servant doctrine a question of law to be decided by the court or a question of fact reserved for the jury? That was the
yes.
issue that you framed,
yes.
and that's the only issue that the court took. As to that line of cases, LaRocca, Gibraltar, Volt, Yonkers from the Court of Errors and Appeals all say it's a question of fact. Do you have contrary case law?
Your Honor, yes. On the issue of whether the borrowed servant doctrine should be determined as a question of, as a matter of law or a question of fact, I believe first we look at Galveo, and what we tried to do in our brief was give a little bit of a summary of the law on the borrowed servant doctrine. So if you look at
Did Galveo address that issue?
Galveo did not say this is something to be determined by a jury, and Galveo did not say this should be determined as a matter of law. There's no question.
And did it overrule prior cases that appear to have answered that question?
Well, on the borrowed servant doctrine issue, Mr. Chief Justice, I believe, first of all, if you look at how Galveo was treated, it was a question of law all the way through. It was summary judgment. Then there was the appellate division decision that didn't make any real deference to those findings, but did a separate analysis, and so did the Supreme Court.
So I have a question about
sure.
Just because a case is decided on summary judgment does not mean that that issue is always a pure question of law, right? So, for example, you could have a negligence case, and negligence is typically a question of fact that is determined by a jury. But one party could request summary judgment, saying something like, viewing all evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff and granting the plaintiff all reasonable inferences therefrom, there is no evidence from which a reasonable jury could conclude that the jury was negligent. The case would then be decided on summary judgment, but that doesn't mean that negligence in general is a pure question of law. It just means that in that case, there was no evidence that the defendant was negligent. How is that different from the case here? Are you arguing that a borrowed employee question is always a pure question of law, somehow like a question of statutory interpretation? And if so, why would you need a bench trial to determine it? Because a bench trial is to determine questions of fact. It's to determine questions of fact by the judge, but it's not to determine pure questions of law.
Well, clearly this is, it wouldn't be accurate for me to argue that this didn't involve mixed questions of fact and law. And I want to try to answer your question and at the same time definitely try to answer the chief's question about the precedent. We're talking about the borrowed servant doctrine. So the precedent prior to Galveo was really Volpe. And Volpe was looking at, really was looking at a workers' compensation case, and was looking at immunity and whether the general employer would be entitled to the same immunity. But it got into the borrowed servant doctrine analysis by, and what really all it did was, what the Volpe court did was it remanded the borrowed servant doctrine issue to be determined prior to trial. That was the words that came from this court. And Volpe and Galveo were what we had as practitioners.
Didn't Volpe expressly say this evidence raises a jury question?
Well, but on the issue of, Your Honor, on the issue of my reading of Volpe is that on the issue of the borrowed servant doctrine, it indicated, and I think we quoted it here, that should be addressed, that to address that issue prior to trial. And our takeaway from that was that the borrowed servant doctrine issue on respondeat superior was one that should be determined, a determination to be made as a matter of law. So I...
Correct me if I'm wrong, and I may have it wrong. Yonkers found that this question goes to the jury, and Volpe says, it's just reiterating that. No?
Our takeaway from Volpe was it reserved, and again, this was an interpretation that we were, so we can't argue this without looking at the agreement that happened in this case. We all thought that it should be a determination to be made as a matter of law. And
you said you thought it should be determined by a bench trial, so that's not quite the same as a determination that's a pure question of law, right?
I agree. And Volpe sent it back for remand when there were mixed questions of fact and law as well. But I think when we intermingle the concept of what the agreement was, listen, if the court wants to announce, because Galveo's silent, right, as to how the determination should be made. Should it be a jury question? Should it be determined as a matter of law? I don't think that the parties were completely off base to evaluate it and believe that it should have been determined by the reserved for the trial court. If this court wants to clarify Galveo further and say, hey, from now on, we'll have a model jury charge on it, or from now on, these factors that are set forth in Galveo should be examined by a jury, that's fine. But what we would ask for today is prospective application of that. And I think we've set forth case law about why, in fairness, prospective application is something that should occur here, particularly because you just simply can't ignore, first of all, you don't have Galveo giving real instruction to the bar about how it should be handled. So you may be announcing, if you want to go that route, you may be announcing a slightly new rule.
I hear what you're saying. So what I'd like you to do is tell us, is there a case that expressly says this is a question of law, the borrowed servant doctrine?
No, and I don't think the answer is no, Your Honor. Galveo tightened up Volpe by describing what the test is going to be now, right? And it relegated business furtherance to a secondary aspect of it. And we took as the procedural history of Galveo, all of us, plaintiff's counsel, defense counsel, and ultimately the court, believed that based on the history of Galveo that it should be determined as a matter of law.
Are you suggesting that there's anything unworkable or problematic with the multi-factor test and the model jury charge that has been developed for the jury deciding under all these factors if the person was under the control of the defendant and also the one that caused the accident and whether it was in furtherance of the business? I mean, looking at these various factors, as a practitioner, are you saying to us, this is too complicated or challenging for a jury, or that we need a channel with some kind of verdict form what they do? Or are you satisfied that it is workable? Just in this case, the deal that was made was to have the judge do it.
I don't want to say I don't have a horse in the race. I do think, I think we've advocated that it should, our view was it should continue to be determined as a matter of law. But again, if the court wants to create a model jury charge that's specific to this doctrine and have the jury determine it, I'm not saying I think that's too complicated for a jury to figure out, Justice. I don't think it would be.
Mr. Midner,
yes.
And I'm sorry to come back to the same question.
Please.
You said you think it should continue to be considered as a matter of law, and that's what I'm wrestling with. Where is it stated that it should be treated as a matter of law that you're asking us to continue?
It's not. The parties interpret it Galveo.
In this case, the parties said we want the judge to make the call.
We did.
That's not essentially a legal analysis, is it?
Well, I will say that when we jointly urged the court to do that, we thought we were correct. Our interpretation of Galveo was it's a determination to be made as
a matter
of law. So,
again, you're talking just specifically about this case. Are you representing that in your experience it's the case that this question has been answered by the judges as a matter of law? Or, again, just talking about what happened in this
right.
case?
I'm just talking about this case. I don't think I've ever had another borrowed servant doctrine case that I can recall.
In terms of what happened in this case, you mentioned that you wanted the judge to determine the question as a bench trial. But in reality, you ended up bringing a motion under Rule 440-1.
Yes.
And doesn't that motion itself require the trial court to accept, quoting, as true all the evidence which supports the position of the party defending against the motion and according him the benefit of all inferences which can reasonably and legitimately be deduced therefrom?
That's clearly the case law. I don't think Rule 40 itself talks about inferences, but that's clearly Justice, you cited exactly what I believe the standard is when you set out that. We styled this motion 440. In all candor, that's how it was styled. There was no inferences raised by the plaintiffs in opposition to that motion ever at the trial level. And
what does that mean?
I'll tell you what it means. The notion of inferences wasn't raised until we were in the appellate division because we had
unconscious that they were entitled to all inferences being weighed in their favor.
Correct. They didn't argue in opposition to the motion at any point during the trial or when we argued before the trial judge how the borrowed servant doctrine issue should be decided based on the facts. There was no argument at the trial level that they were entitled to inferences. I totally.
But on summary judgment, I mean, if you look at the summary judgment standard, that you look at the facts in the manner most favorable to the non-moving party, et cetera, right?
I agree.
If you went to argue, and I'm sure you've argued probably hundreds of summary judgment motions, you don't say to every judge, by the way, judge, we're here on summary judgment. Therefore, I am arguing that you must review the facts and give the inferences to my client, the non-moving party, right?
I agree.
So I don't. It doesn't seem to be. If the rule has a particular standard, it doesn't seem to be a waiver of any argument on their part to have not asserted that you have to look at the facts with all the inferences being drawn in their favor.
Fair. I think it's worth pointing out that there was no attempt to. We were dealing with uncontroverted facts when it came to control, whether it was on spot or broad or business furtherance. These were simple, straightforward facts. So I agree, Justice. I agree with what you're saying. Of course, you don't claim people waived it during a typical summary judgment, but this was anything but typical. I understand that this is unusual, but we were all, including the trial judge, trying to work through an issue that we didn't feel we had absolute clarity on about how it should be handled. And the defense had made a motion for summary judgment on the borrowed servant, and it had been denied because there were disputed issues of fact that were found.
Was your side concerned about having the jury make the call? Because of the atmospherics of the case or fairness? Was there something about the strategically about not wanting the jury to make the decision?
I truthfully, to answer Your Honor's question, from the defense perspective, I was more comfortable with the trial judge making this determination. But again, this was an absolute joint application, and I quoted to you the words that came right from the plaintiff's mouth. But I wanted to answer also what Justice Patterson asked about these inferences. I can't hide from the fact that we called it a 440 motion, right?
And I'm guessing, because I've been there, there are some times when your motion doesn't fit anywhere.
There isn't an appropriate thing to call what our motion was. But the inferences under 440, that's when you're trying to take something away from the jury. You're looking for a really big home run here to end a case and take it away from the jury. Here, we'd all agreed it was taken away from the jury to begin with. So the appropriateness of applying inferences, I believe, is gone. I can't hide from the court that we styled it that. And I can't deny what you said, Justice, about what the standard is. But there were no...
And I understand why you would do that, because it's important to give judges motions that they are generally familiar with. But that one comes with some baggage.
Understood. We just didn't have something to style it with. And secondarily to the inferences, because I would like to talk about them, because I was obviously surprised by and unhappy with the outcome in the appellate division, but the facts that were central to the borrowed servant analysis are pretty limited and pretty tight, and they all come pretty much from Mr. Santomo's testimony. And I personally, whether inferences were entitled to be taken or not, if you look at the inferences that the appellate division made, and with all due respect, I think some of these inferences got completely spun out of whole cloth. And if I could, I'd like to just address a couple of them just by way of example, if the court would permit. The first one was when the appellate division was doing their business furtherance analysis, and I'm quoting here, they say, a reasonable inference from the record is that the arrangement under which Giamella and other mechanics were hired by MT and thereafter loaned to CSNJ was financially beneficial to both companies. MT benefited by having mechanics on the payroll who could perform services for MT at a lower rate than if MT had purchased such services from CSNJ. I'm almost done. Moreover, by ensuring a sufficient number of qualified mechanics on site, the arrangement assisted in drawing customers to the container depot. This is completely, an inference, and we set forth the law, has to be tethered to some base fact. This is totally untethered from any fact in the record. The customers of MT, they don't even come to the site. Marine Transport's business is when a container arrives down at Newark, the container gets shipped to, take an example, the A&P warehouse. They're the intermodal freight carrier that makes that happen. The appellate division is going through this whole, something described as an inference of things that don't even happen.
Wouldn't that be based in part on MT's website, which evidently said, we provide repair services to many steamship lines within the Port of New York. Our seasoned, well-respected ILA dry and reefer mechanics can perform repairs, both major and minor. So it doesn't sound like the appellate division was just making it up whole cloth. Instead, it sounds like the appellate division was referring to MT's website where it says, our seasoned, well-respected ILA dry and reefer mechanics can perform repairs both major and minor. They were advertising that as their service.
So 2 points on that. Again, no dispute about what the website says. These two companies they have some common ownership, just like in Galveo, but they are separate companies.
They didn't hold themselves out.
Well, the website itself, and Mr. Santomo testified to this, he didn't even think Container Services had a website. So, yes, there is no question, Justice, that when they created that website, it was inartful and it says what it says. There's no question. But when you're doing the Galveo analysis and you're talking about what was Mr. Giammello, the loan employee, doing on the date the accident happened, where his actions were alleged to have caused, you know, damage to the plaintiff? What does the, and I'm not dismissing what you're asking, but I'm saying rhetorically, what does the website have to do with it? Who controlled him on that date?
So in terms of Mr. Santomo controlling him, wasn't the evidence also that even though he was a CSNJ employee, he was listed as the primary customer contact on MT's website, and he had an MT email address?
Yes, and again, he testified, he was asked about that on cross, and he testified, I don't think Container Services had a website. So his email address was Marine Transport. There's no question about it. But he also testified that he was an employee of Container Services, that they're the ones that paid his salary, and that the work that Mr. Giammello was doing, that he controlled it on a day-to-day basis. He controlled it on the day of the accident. And the only company that reaped the benefit from the work that Mr. Giammello did was Container Services. But no question, Justice, that the website is, there's good facts and bad facts in every case. That's not a good fact, if you're here standing in my shoes making this argument. So it says what it says, but the testimony, and I would urge the court to focus on exactly what was happening on that date. And that evidence demonstrates that the control sat with Container Services.
What about the evidence that Mr. Stouffer, who's a shop steward and an intermediate, I guess, mm-hmm. between Mr. Santomo and the mechanics, what about the evidence that he's paid both by MT and CSNJ?
What I would say about that evidence is I suggest the relevance of it. It's Mr. Giammello. Listen, these companies are co-owned. They exist on the same
who
property.
Who controls Mr. Giammello, right? And so if Mr.
And that's Mr. Santomo.
But Mr. Stouffer is the one right under Santomo and between him and Mr. Giammello, right?
The direct, the testimony, the direct supervisor, the one who calls all the shots and the shots that implicate Mr. Giammello is Santomo.
It seems like all of this is are facts that, as you mentioned, might not be, there might be facts, there might be contrary facts, but it seems like all of this is facts that the appellate division could use and that they were not creating things out of whole cloth.
Okay, I believe they made some credibility determinations as in a court of original jurisdiction that the trial court should have made. I believe that some of these inferences, I have another inference for you where the appellate division, they say, to what degree was Santomo acting as Giammello's shadow supervisor for MT, as well as his direct supervisor for his employer, CSNJ? That question was never asked or answered. That said, the inference is to be drawn in plaintiff's favor. A task we are bound to perform compels that we view his testimony with some skepticism, considering the evidence. Well, he was asked and answered that. And he testified that he was the supervisor for Giammello, and Giammello had no corresponding supervisor at MT. So, and I'm saying as respectfully as I can about the inferences that the appellate division found, that's not only grounded in any fact, that's contrary. That's contrary to the evidence.
We're coming up on a half hour now.
Oh, that was quick.
Is there anything else you'd like to add before we draw this part of the argument to a close?
No, I hope that I've answered all of your questions.
Thank you.